This podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
I'm Veronica Belmont.
I'm Tom Merritt.
And this is kind of a mishmash episode of sorts. We've got some news for you. We've got some chattering going on in the Goodreads group.
Episode of MASH.
In a very special episode of MASH, Veronica and Tom talk about things like the World War Z.
Yeah, it's on this episode of MASH, Hawkeye operates on a zombie to save his life. Yeah, so we've finished up with World War Z. We'll get to how we're going to choose the next book at the end of the episode, but let us start off with some quick burns.
Let us regale you with some of the news going on in the science fiction and fantasy community.
I thought it'd be good to start checking in on what the top-selling books are. Mm-hmm. And one place to find top-selling sci-fi and fantasy books is Amazon.com. One would think that's, where a lot of folks who like sci-fi and fantasy would shop.
Definitely.
And it turns out that Stephanie Meyer and Charlaine Harris pretty much dominate that list.
Yo, they got that crap locked down. They got locked down for vampires.
Yeah, vampires count as fantasy. So with the Twilight movie coming out and with True Blood just returning to HBO, there's not much else going on. However, they are not the number one bestseller in science fiction and fantasy.
No, and that actually goes to The Darkest Lie by Gina Showalter.
Which is a romance about supernatural beings.
And number four in the list is The Dangerous Dimension by L. Ron Hubbard.
Who's dead?
Yeah, how did he do that?
You know, this happens. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't just happen to L. Ron Hubbard. It happens to all kinds of authors where they dig up works or they find something that, maybe wasn't all that popular when they first put it out and it was never republished and they put it out again and it hits the bestsellers.
No, but I was talking more about how did L. Ron Hubbard get on the top sellers list just because
he's actually a very popular science fiction writer.
I know.
Veronica.
I know.
But yeah, it's funny too. If you look, the Kindle editions seem to be the fastest sellers.
I think that's very interesting. What percent now are you buying on Kindle versus actual books, would you say?
I would say it's about 70% Kindle, or in a couple of cases, non-Kindle but ebook, but mostly Kindle.
I would say it's about 95% for me Kindle.
Wow. See, I don't think it's that high for me because there are books I want to read that don't come out on Kindle.
I just don't read them now.
You just, wow. No, bold words from Veronica Belmont, ladies and gentlemen.
I have turned into a straight-up Kindle fangirl. Kindle fangirl. I know there's some of us out there. I know there are also people who are steadfastly anti-Kindle. And I can respect that, kind of. But
I suppose.
I need the convenience. I need the instant gratification. I need to just be able to say, oh, that sounds interesting. I'm going to download that immediately and read it now.
I've started to get that way with comics, actually, in the Comixology app on the iPad. It's like, no, I just want to read them on the iPad. But I still have books like Douglas Coupland's Generation A. It wasn't out for Kindle right away. And I said, no, I want to read that book. And so I ordered the book. And it's nice to have books. And there's even sometimes where, actually, with Mists of Avalon, I bought it on Kindle, read it on Kindle, and then bought the hardback.
That is interesting. I did the same thing with Anathem. I bought it in hardcover, and then I proceeded to not want to lug it around, and so I bought it on Kindle.
Yeah. But I like the hardcover of Mists of Avalon was a really nice hardback, and I was like, oh, you know what? I want to have that on my shelf, to just grab and page through for that tactile sensation.
I used to really love collecting books. And then when this is a little personal note, when Ryan and I moved in together, I was like, hey, we should put all our books up on a bookshelf. And he was like, no. And I was like, why? He's like, because your books are kind of embarrassing.
Oh, he did not.
They are kind of embarrassing, I guess.
Why? Because they're all about dragons?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's nothing embarrassing about that. That's what this entire podcast is about.
I know. He's just got to embrace that side of me.
You should put those books up.
I will. One day he'll come home and they'll be up everywhere.
And you should film it.
Surprise, honey. Surprise.
Well, here's a book that is out today, out this week. Brand new book in Kindle, hardcover, or paperback, whichever ideology you cling to. I'm always forgetting how to
person's
name. It's China Mieville.
Mieville.
Mieville. M-I-E-V-I-L-L-E. And
a little dink over the E. A little dink.
Yeah, there's an accent. Accent
at all.
Or something like that.
Mieville.
But he is out with a new book called Kraken, which...
Would you say that he recently released a book called The Kraken?
I think this week China released the Kraken.
Yeah, the Kraken book. I know, because it's not called The Kraken, so you have to add book at the end to make it funny.
He is the author of The City and the City and Perdido Street Station,
which I loved.
And so this returns to the world of Perdido Street Station, a fantasy London where anything is possible. Billy Harrow is a dedicated scientist who never imagined being caught up in intrigue. Who does? but after he successfully preserves a giant squid, I'm in, he comes to the attention of the Krakenists, an obscure cult that worships squids.
Interesting.
When the giant squid mysteriously disappears from the museum in the middle of the day, Billy is drawn into the world of cult, magic, and Armageddon. He's arrested by the fundamentalist and sect-related crime unit, with a young witch as their tough-talking cop, and then escapes with Dane, a warrior in the Kraken Church. So,
is this really the same world? Because it doesn't sound like the same world.
I think it's the same London. In other words, like, oh yeah, Perdido Street Station is in the same London, but we're
That wasn't in London. That's the thing.
Oh yeah, that's true.
It was like an alternate history. Not even a really alternate history. It was just kind of like a different world.
Yeah, I think this is.
More alternate history-ish?
This is, seems a little more either alternate or not so distant future kind of history.
Gotcha.
Like where the Krakenists have arisen.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's a very. If you're into H.P. Lovecraft, sounds like you might like this. But brand new, just came out. Something to throw on the list.
Yeah.
And especially if you like to say. Release the Kraken. You're going to love this book.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look that up because now I'm really curious. Because it does say in that review on the Amazon page that it's the same world.
It does.
But I'm pretty sure there was no London involved in Perdido Street Station.
Yeah.
New Corbizon was the name of the city.
When they say world, I wonder Corbizon. Then what they mean there.
Maybe they just mean that kind of general vibe, because it sounds like a very similar kind of story. I mean, two scientists in a very, you know, steampunky kind of world, I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. So similar themes for sure. Large animals that somehow escape mysteriously from captivity.
Steam Kraken.
All right, I can get behind that. Release the steam Kraken.
If you're not into Krakens, though, you might be thinking, I would like to read something on my vacation at the beach. And who better to take your recommendations from than prominent scientists?
And what do they recommend?
Well, Dr. Mae C. Jameson, who became the first African-American woman to travel in space, recommends Kindred by Octavia Butler.
Ah, excellent. And then, but the recommendations from primatologist Jane Goodall are also pretty fascinating, according to IO9. Let's see. She says that you should read, where's the book? A Day of the Triffids by John Wyndham.
Here's what she says. It has some sad commentaries on human nature. It makes me think of all the other forms life could have taken.
Like,
we could have been Triffids.
They could have been Triffids.
She also recommends Out of the Silent Planet, the C.S. Lewis space trilogy.
Oh, very cool. Hey, and speaking of Octavia Butler, she was actually just inducted into the Science Fiction Hall of Fame at Seattle Science Fiction Museum.
Is right. And congratulations to her, as well as Roger Zelazny and Richard Matheson. Zelazny, a prominent science fiction author. We've mentioned some of his books before on the show, but Douglas Trumbull also got inducted. He is the one who is a special effects maestro. So he got inducted for special effects in 2001, A Space Odyssey and Blade Runner.
Yeah, very cool.
Nice job, Douglas Trumbull. The pretty good space effects in both those movies.
Yeah, you like how I said that Octavia Butler was recently introduced to the Science Fiction Hall of Fame.
Octavia, we'd like you to meet the Science Fiction Hall of Fame.
Science Fiction Hall of Fame. This is Octavia. I think you two will get along splendidly.
Yes. So I didn't realize that the Science Fiction Hall of Fame was in Seattle. Did you?
Yes, I did. I've actually visited it.
Well,
I visited it and they were closed, so I didn't go in.
You didn't get inside?
No.
That is sad.
They were closed for the day, but I'll be back. Oh, yes, I will be back.
And if you know, and I skipped over Richard Matheson after Zelazny. Matheson wrote I Am Legend.
Oh, very cool.
And several Twilight Zone episodes as well.
Yeah. So there's another story that we wanted to cover from Boing Boing, and Tom brought this to my attention because he thought it would be right up my alley in terms of interests, and it's about a graphic novel called Black Sad, and
there's plenty of comic book podcasts out there, so we don't always go into graphic novels, but when you tell them what it's about, they'll understand.
It is about a hard-boiled detective that also happens to be a cat. It's a whole world of anthropomorphic animals, and it's not apparently done in a cheesy way. It's done in a very serious way. The animals are kind of like totems to like the personalities of the characters they're trying to portray.
Yeah, this is not cute, fuzzy, like, oh, look at the kitty solving the crimes.
Oh, you're a little crime solver.
Somewhere in the shadows, about a rich and powerful man offing his lover and getting away clean. Arctic Nation, a white supremacist demagogue kidnaps a poor girl, and Red Soul, the communist witch hunt, overshadows the story of murder and betrayal. These are all pretty film noirish stories, and there's three of them in Black Sad.
I want to check this one out. It sounds pretty good.
And the art looks really cool, too.
Yeah. All right, well, now it's time to get into some Barrier Sword, where we talk about feedback from the audience and what you guys are talking about in the Goodreads group. Now, we've got two books going on this month. We had World War Z, and we also had a little bit of The Blade Itself by Joe Abercrombie.
Which, I have to get going on The Blade Itself.
What?
Itself.
Haven't caught up to that one yet, huh?
It's on my Kindle. I'm ready to go with it.
Yeah. I just finished, I'm just midway through the second book, Before They're Hanged, I believe it's called, which is the second book in the trilogy that starts with The Blade Itself. And it's good. People warned me a little bit. I know we're getting off topic, but people warned me a little bit that the trilogy slows down a bit, and maybe that will happen, but it hasn't yet. I'm still really, really enjoying this series.
I got sucked into reading comic books, The Walking Dead, because that's coming to television on AMC. And so I've caught up on that series. And I was also reading Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which is the entire text of the Philip K. Dick novel put to pictures and illustrated as a comic book. And so I feel like it's an appropriate thing to talk about on Sword and Laser, because it's not just a comic book or an adaptation. It's the actual text of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And then put, you know, with illustrations, so you can see what's happening as you're reading the book. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. So the first topic of discussion does go back to World War Z, and it was started by Michael, and he wanted to talk about the evils of the Redeker Plan.
Ah, yes.
Now, the Redeker Plan is obviously, it's a little bit complicated, but it basically has to do with, you know, who do you protect? You know, what kind of strategic locations do you protect? And, you know, sometimes people get left out of that and people are casualties of war. And if you're stuck in a non-strategic location, you know, help may not come.
Not only that, but, you know, they're a little vague on how the Redeker Plan actually works in practice. But there's allusions to using populations as decoys or as shields. So you know they're going to die, and you're actually using them to attract the zombies so that you can get your other group away. So it's really freaking controversial.
It's pretty hardcore, yeah. And you can actually read about it all on Zombiepedia, which is a Wikia page that is linked to from this Goodreads post as well. So if you want to get, you know, all knowledgeable about this fictitious plan of action in case the zombie apocalypse comes, you will be the expert. But Michael just wanted to know, you know, we talked a little bit about good and evil and bitter seeds. So is this good? Is this evil? Is it just necessary? And then there's a pretty long discussion that goes on after that point.
Well, this is the classic ethical dilemma that they'll teach in philosophy classes and ethics classes where, you know, you say, okay, you've got three people in a boat and you're out of food. And if you eat one of the people, the other two will survive. How do you choose?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, and so you've gotten rid of the evil thing, right? Like nobody's killing someone for no reason. There's a survival reason.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the Redeker plan is like, which is if we don't do this, we lose to the zombies and they inherit the earth and the human race dies. So how do you justify sacrificing people and how do you choose who gets sacrificed in order to save the human race?
Well, that's exactly what Hillary says, actually, in this post. She says, also, I don't think the Redeker warrants any merit at all. Sure, some people will survive, but in the end, if that society needs to sacrifice a majority of their population, the same people that could have helped fight the zombies if the leadership weren't panicking and actually formulating proper plans and educating people on how to fight, that society is completely screwed anyway. You start
like
running out of people, the more solid waves of zombies you got. In fact, assuming the zombies converted most of their bait instead of feasting, they would get more and more zombies and less bait. Instead of running around in circles screaming, we need to save our elite in order for our society to survive. What does that mean anyway? They could have pushed more experienced fighters towards the front while evacuating people and educating them on what they should do when they see zombies.
All right, I vote her in charge of zombie defense.
Yes, yes. And, you know, that actually reminds me a lot of, did you watch 2012?
Yes, I have it on Blu-ray.
Well, I don't want to say any spoilers, but at the end, you kind of get a similar kind of scenario about saving the elite.
Like, who do you save?
Right.
Who's important? All of that. Yeah, yeah.
And all that kind of goes to hell in a way.
There always are positions, and maybe, you know, maybe she's right that the Redeker plan wasn't inevitable, but the author was trying to make it sound as if it was. And so there are always those positions of what do you do when you come up against this inevitable point where, you know, the society isn't by choice choosing to sacrifice some of its population. It just can't help it.
Mm-hmm. And then Sean has a really interesting post that I want to actually go through and read the source post that he's linking to. It's about Daniel Dresner has a long essay in Foreign Policy magazine on the political implications of a zombie uprising. Now, this is a real author writing in a real magazine about what the political implications would be of a zombie uprising. And he says, how would the introduction of flesh-eating ghouls affect world politics? The realist answer is simple, if surprising. International relations would be largely unaffected. Although some would see in a zombie invasion a new existential threat to the human condition, realists would be unimpressed by the claim that the zombie arrival would lead to any radical change in human behavior. To them, a plague of the undead would merely echo older plagues, from the Black Death of the 14th century to the 1918 influenza pandemic. To paraphrase...
Thucydides,
thank you. The real politic of zombies is that the strong will do what they can and the weak must suffer devouring by reanimated, ravenous corpses.
You know, I'm afraid he's probably right.
Yeah.
Which is to say, we have actually been through in this world plagues and wars that were as devastating as World War Z is made out to be.
At least on a local level.
Oh, and in Europe, in the Black Death.
Well, yeah, I mean, in a local continent.
On a large level. Or you could, I guess, regional maybe.
It's not worldwide. We haven't exactly suffered.
World War II were maybe the closest we've ever come to a worldwide thing. And even that wasn't universally worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we can see how, you know, even in these tragedies, governments continue. Some semblance of normal commerce makes it through to the other side.
Mm-hmm.
But also, a lot of social norms break down if you read the histories of these. So
right.
I don't know. I mean, there's a whole longer essay that Dresner has that goes into the sort of the nuances of this. But I think he's right. You know, you basically your power elites hole up in castles, which is essentially the Redeker plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then they bunker down until it passes, and then they come back out and reestablish their authority and control.
That's almost comforting in a way. Mm. In a small way. No? Okay. All right. Well, how about this
depends
for a little bit of fun?
Get to go in the castle or not, I think.
Yeah, I guess true. All right. For a little bit of fun, Lepton started a thread on the blade itself, wondering if modern profanity breaks fantasy immersion. There's a lot of curse words in the blade itself. A lot of F words, a lot of S words, a few C words. Just, you know, off the top of my head, that's what I can remember. So do you think it breaks the feeling of a fantasy novel, or do you think it makes it feel more realistic? How do you feel, Tom?
I don't have a problem with cursing. I'll just put that out there. Mm-hmm. I respect the fact that other people do. And so, you know, it, depending on what kind of media I'm creating, I avoid it where I don't feel like it's necessary to make my point.
Well, and for example, earlier in the show today, I said crap instead of what probably would have made more sense to say,
right,
the S word. I just can't do it.
But when you're talking about fiction and when you're talking about capturing sort of a slice of life, I think that people curse. They do it all the time. And you may not like it, but they do. And so you're capturing the way people really speak. Now, science fiction and fantasy obviously is not a slice of real life. It's a reflection of real life, perhaps, mm-hmm, but not, you know, it's taking you out of that. So when you say like, well, why are they, when they curse, it takes me out of it. I think there's a case to be made depending on how it's used, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, if it sounds modern and it's supposed to be, you know, 2,000 years from now, that it's not the cursing that takes me out of it. It's the fact that it sounds too familiar.
Well, for me,
you know what I mean?
Yeah. For me, it's like with the blade itself, they don't use, as I like to call it, old-timey fantasy talk. Like, they're not using the old-style Arthurian, like, you know, fancy, like, thou art, you know, a douchebag.
Ye, so, my fair maiden, you get the crap up here.
You poppycock, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah.
So in the blade itself, they just use regular modern English, you know, 99% of the time. So for me, it makes total sense to have curse words, swear words, whatever, thrown in, because that's just how we talk. You know,
yeah,
it just fits in with the style of language that they're using in general. So it doesn't take me out of the storyline. Now, if we were reading, you know, Mists of Avalon, and suddenly they started throwing around the F word, then I'd be like a little, oh, okay. Even
yeah,
though they don't use like straight up old timey, you know, old English style of speaking, it wouldn't fit in with the setting and the way that people were talking in that book.
So to me, it's whether you're using a jargon that sticks out.
Right.
And in this case, that is not the issue. And so I think there are some people who are just like, you know what? I don't like profanity. I just don't like it. And,
but that's a
and
different thing, is it not?
And when I see it, it's jarring and it breaks me out of it. And it's like, well, yeah, exactly. I think that is a different thing.
It's a different kind of thing for sure. But anyway, all right. Well, I think that's all we've got for discussion topics. Should we discuss how we're going to pick our next book?
We should. How do you want to pick our next book?
Well, I was thinking, Tom, that we should maybe start a thread on the Goodreads page and have people just throw out a few names, some books they've wanted to read. We want to keep it kind of genre specific this time because we've really been going off the path a little bit lately. What with the zombies?
I don't know about this idea, Veronica. I have a better idea. I think we should start a thread on Goodreads where people can suggest books that are more genre specific.
Yeah, that sounds great.
What do you think?
That's yeah? A great idea. That was the best idea you have ever had.
No, I think you're right, because we've been doing a lot of modern mainstream-ish fiction, which has been great. But we it's been a while since we did a classic, you know, either fantasy or sci-fi. So yeah, what we're saying is throw your suggestions out, and even if it's just an author, like, gosh, I'd love to read something by Isaac Asimov or whatever author it is, or if you're like a type, a subgenre, like, I really want to read about dragons, that's helpful too, because it's not going to be a vote on the thread. We just want ideas, and then Veronica and I will make up a list, and we'll have an actual poll with an actual vote.
Right. Yeah, I think that sounds fair. We've been a little dictatorial lately. Yeah. All right, good. Yeah. We'll all set up that thread, and then you guys can go over there to the Goodreads page and pick what you want to read, or at least tell us what you would like to hear.
So fight we have the power. Tell us what you want to read.
Yeah. Revolt. Wait, no, don't actually revolt. Just help us pick.
Don't revolt. Keep listening.
Do you want to read this email from Simon?
Yeah. Simon wrote to theswordandlaser@gmail.com. Hey, Veronica, Tom, first let me say I'm liking the greater frequency of Sword and Laser. Hope to see more.
Thank you.
Add me to the tally of people Veronica has introduced to Temeraire. Woo-hoo! I recently finished Victory of the Eagles. It's an amazing series, and I look forward to more. Game of Thrones on HBO. Here's the thing about the Ice and Fire books. They are incredible books. However, I had to stop reading after the third one because it literally depressed me.
Aww.
If the HBO series is near as good, I doubt I'll be able to watch it.
which is too bad. Okay. All right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that's hilarious where he's like, please don't be too good or it will depress me. Because it is a depressing story.
Oh, yeah.
In many
Big
ways.
Time. Especially if you're the type of person that gets attached to characters. Don't. Mm-hmm. Just don't.
Yeah. She's worse than J.K. Rowling, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, now is the time in the show where we thank our partner StickerFoo. Use the code SWORD1 and get 10% off the stickers at www.stickerfoo.com.
Absolutely. We love the foo. F-U.
We love the foo. And if you want to get in touch with us, as Tom said, the email address is theswordandlaser@gmail.com. You can visit our website at swordandlaser.com. Subscribe in iTunes. Subscribe in RSS. Leave us some comments on the iTunes page. Give us some good rankings if you're enjoying the show. Tell your friends and family. That would be awesome. And finally, of course, join the discussion over at Goodreads. You can either follow the discussions tab at the top of our website or to search for Sword and Laser on Goodreads.com.
That's it for now. Thanks everybody for listening. We'll talk to you next time with the kickoff of our
Woohoo! See you later.